WGNS, Murfreesboro.
This is FM 100.5, 101.9, AM 1450, and WGNSradio.com. Rutherford County's place to talk. Stand by, Rutherford County. The WGNS Action Line continues a search for truth.
Yes, we want to welcome everyone to the program. My name is J. Paul Newman. My co-host is District Attorney General William C. Weitzel, Jr. We appreciate WGNS airing this broadcast, and we want to thank you for listening. During today's broadcast, on our Call to Conviction segment, we will review a trial from the past. And in that segment, we have a very special guest. Retired Judge Steve Daniel will be here to discuss the brutal murder of Donald Roscoe Greenwood in 1998. Judge Steve Daniel presided over the trial of that case. I think you will find Judge Daniel's insight both interesting and educational. This horrific murder occurred here in Murfreesboro, Tennessee. It was one of the most violent murders the Murfreesboro police have ever investigated. And you will find some of the facts of this case very disturbing. Listener discretion is advised. Also on today's broadcast will be Rutherford County Deputy Court Clerk Robin Gentry. Robin will tell us about upcoming trials in Rutherford County and give the listeners information about a scam that they should be aware of. And during the Look at the Law segment, Judge Steve Daniel and General Weitzel will have a lively discussion about the rules of criminal procedure and evidence that govern a criminal trial. And in the final segment of the broadcast, we will ask all of the listeners to help solve a mystery. Law enforcement will be asking for your help in solving a 37-year-old murder. This is the murder of Stanley Smith, who lived on Richmond Avenue here in Murfreesboro and died on or near the Stones River National Battlefield. Telling us about the Stanley Smith murder will be Sergeant Dan Goodwin and Commander Bill Sharp of the Rutherford County Cold Case Unit. We welcome you to the program and thank you for listening, and we ask for your help in seeking justice. We will begin the broadcast after you listen to these important messages.
Hello, I'm Dave Gober with FNB Mortgage.
And Dean Higby with South Branch Nursery.
Be sure to tune in every Saturday for the Rutherford Home Show presented by Old South Properties.
We are joined each week by local professionals to give helpful information about your home and the local community.
We also give you local real estate stats and rate information.
Join us here on WGNS for the Rutherford Home Show.
Saturdays at noon with Dean Higby and Dave Gober here on WGNS.
The ARC Tennessee advocates for the rights and full participation of all people with intellectual and or developmental disabilities. We are hosting our second annual Hearts Take Flight Pull a Plane Challenge at 10 a.m. on April 12th at the Smyrna Rutherford County Airport. Teams of 10 will pull a huge jet across the tarmac, and the fastest time gets bragging rights and a cool trophy. This event is open to the public, and we encourage you to register a team at musiccityplanepool.org. Again, that's musiccityplanepool.org.
Hi, this is Amanda at Animal City. I'm inviting your family to come do business with my family. And here at Animal City, we have everything that you need to create and maintain the garden pond of your dreams. We're happy to offer tips and advice ranging from picking out your equipment to outfitting your pond with livestock and plants. Come see us at Animal City, 919 Northwest Broad Street in Murfreesboro, and let our experience and expertise make your garden pond a success.
Bell Jewelers on Broad Street, across from Toots.
I'm Greg Tidwell.
And I'm Lisa Halliburton. Bell Jewelers welcomes you.
Most $10 watch batteries are replaced while you wait at Bell Jewelers.
Visit the world of Rolex at Bell Jewelers, your official Rolex jeweler. Sales and in-house Rolex repair.
Bell Jewelers on Broad Street, across from Toots.
Visit us at belljeweler.com. Like us on Facebook.
At the Salvation Army Family Store, you can get bargain prices on clothes, furniture, household goods, electronics, and more. Every Wednesday, get 50% off most items in the store.
All the clothes that we have in the store, no matter what color tag it is half off.
Store manager Mark Sheridan.
Usually, we do run some other type of sale on the furniture and other things that we do sell here in the family store.
Your purchases go directly to fund Salvation Army programs here in Rutherford County. The Salvation Army Family Store is at 125 South Front Street, across from Captain D's on Broad.
From call to conviction, time now for a look back at one of the more intriguing and important cases for this community. From the crime, the investigation, to the prosecution.
On February the 20th, 1998, between 5 and 5:30 p.m., 69-year-old Donald Roscoe Greenwood was brutally murdered. Mr. Greenwood was bludgeoned to death with a hammer. He had multiple fractures to his skull. His left ear was severely injured. His right eye was basically destroyed. He suffered numerous broken ribs, and a piece of Mr. Greenwood's skull was found on the floor several feet from his body. Donald Roscoe Greenwood was attacked in his motel room here in the city of Murfreesboro. Mr. Greenwood had recently moved into his room 2 days earlier, on February the 18th, 1998. Mr. Greenwood suffered from Parkinson's disease, and he had moved from Cannon County to Murfreesboro to be closer to Veterans Hospital. The police were summoned to the Jackson Motel by the motel manager, and the manager was asked to call the police by Kenneth Dykus and Deborah Reese. They told the manager that they had found Mr. Greenwood dead in his motel room. When the police arrive, Detective Joel Davis begins the investigation. Assisting in the investigation are Detectives Chris Guthrie and Jim Gage, along with the TBI. In Mr. Greenwood's room, significant amounts of blood were discovered, including on the bathroom sink, the top of the microwave, all over the front of the refrigerator, and on the ceiling. A bloody claw hammer was found underneath a table in the room, and Donald Roscoe Greenwood's lifeless body was also discovered on the floor next to his blood-stained bed. The police became suspicious of Kenneth Paul Dykus and Deborah Reese very quickly based on several factors. The couple appeared to be acting very strangely. The police learned that Dykus and Reese had immediately befriended Mr. Greenwood the very first day they met him. They learned the couple spent most of their time with Mr. Greenwood. They also learned that Mr. Greenwood often paid the way for the couple's daily needs. They also learned that Dykus and Reese were the two last people known to have been with Mr. Greenwood the day he was murdered. Police asked to search Dykus and Reese's room. There, law enforcement finds several important bloodstains. They find a bloodstain on the concrete floor directly outside the Dykus room, which later matches the victim's blood. They find more blood on the door jamb of the Dykus room, which is later determined to be Mr. Greenwood's blood. And most significantly, on a pair of men's work boots that were found underneath Kenneth Dykus's bed, they find another bloodstain, a bloodstain that matches the blood of Donald Roscoe Greenwood. The police take the couple to the Murfreesboro Police Department for questioning. The interviews resulted in the couple being charged with murder. On February 23, 1999, in Judge Steve Daniels' court, Deborah Reese pleads guilty to first-degree murder, especially aggravated robbery, and conspiracy. For the murder, she receives a life sentence. For the especially aggravated robbery, 15 years. For the conspiracy, 8 years. All of the sentences were ordered to be served concurrently. And as part of the plea agreement, Deborah Reese agreed to testify truthfully at the trial of Kenneth Paul Dykus. Kenneth Dykus's trial was also conducted in Judge Steve Daniels' courtroom. Following several days of testimony, a Rutherford County jury found Kenneth Paul Dykus guilty of premeditated first-degree murder, felony murder, especially aggravated robbery, and conspiracy. The jury sentenced Kenneth Dicus to life without the possibility of parole. Consecutive to that sentence, Judge Daniel added a total of 24 years for the conspiracy and especially aggravated robbery convictions. Under these sentences, Kenneth Paul Dicus will never be released from prison. We are honored to have the judge who presided over this case in the studio today. We want to welcome retired Judge Steve Daniel to the WGNS microphones. I had the privilege of appearing in Judge Daniel's court and prosecuting the Dicus and Reese cases with General Weitzel. I know that General Weitzel and Judge Daniel have many years of experience together in court. So I'm going to ask General Weitzel to take the lead and ask Judge Daniel about some of the more interesting aspects of the trial of State of Tennessee versus Kenneth Paul Dicus.
Morning, Judge Daniel. How are you?
Good morning, General. Good to see you again.
Good to see you. I know you remember this trial, and Paul said, it was a very heinous act. What is it that sticks in your mind about this particular case?
One of the things that came to my attention when you asked about it was the way that an elderly man with a good bit of health problems were taken advantage of by these individuals who courted him in the form of trying to solicit his favor and then brutally murdered him after getting the benefit of his largesse in the form of money, and seems to me him buying them products, beer and cigarettes and all of those types of things.
I recall when we were trying the case, of course, he was a veteran. And part of the reason that
he was out at the VA.
Moved here was to be closer to the VA hospital so he could get the treatment that he needed. And something I want to talk about a little bit later, but I remember that we introduced a picture of him in his military uniform to show the jury what he looked like. We've discussed it a little bit. The courts now have made it more and more difficult for the prosecution to introduce what we call life pictures of the deceased. And I know you're aware of that, but back when this case was tried, that was routinely done.
It was.
And I don't know if you remember this or not, but present judge, Judge Bragg, was appointed to represent Mr. Dicus along, I believe, with, was it Gilbert Anglin?
Gilbert Anglin was lead, and Bragg was second in that particular situation.
And you may recall that one of the witnesses in the case worked in a convenience store that was not too far from the Jackson Motel. And I think Mr. Newman was questioning her, and she was identifying the two defendants. And I remember Judge Bragg got up to cross-examine her and said, "Now, how are you so sure that my client was one of these people?" And something she'd never told us, she said, "Well, they had blood on their clothing."
I don't recall that.
Well, I can assure you Judge Bragg does. But in all of our interviews about that, she had never told us that. And when we asked her after she was off the witness stand, "Why didn't you tell us that?" She said, "You never asked me."
Good reason.
But over the course of your career, of course, you've tried many homicide cases. I know there's one that sticks out in your mind. What would that be?
Well, there's many more than one that stick out in my mind. But one of the most tragic series of murder cases that I tried was the McGill murders. And that always comes to mind.
And that was an elderly couple that lived out in the county on a farm.
That's right.
And there, if I recall, there were five young men, I believe, that
That's
were...
Right.
were tried and convicted of their murder.
That's correct.
And that, as I recall, that was five separate trials that
It was.
I think one of them ultimately pled guilty, but that lasted over the course of 2 to 3 years.
I think about 18 months. We were trying one of those cases about every other month, it seems like, and they were multiple-day cases, pretty hard cases.
Of course, one of your more famous trials, I guess, was low-tax looper.
That's true.
Who was convicted of murdering Senator Tommy Burks.
That's right.
And tell us what you remember about that case.
Well, that's one of the most novel cases that I ever got involved in. And one of the things that was so interesting about that case was how bright Mr. Looper was in plotting this out using state law to gain an advantage in an election. One of the reasons for this murder and the timing of it was that Tennessee state law at that time did not allow a political party to replace a candidate who died within 30 days of the election. And his entire purpose was to win the election. He was running for the same Senate seat, was to kill Mr. Senator Burks within 30 days of the election and then basically run unopposed in the election. But little did he know that he would be sort of identified as a potential target. And then even the governor of the state asked that the party that he represented support a write-in ballot for Mr. Burks, Senator Burks' wife, and she was successful.
And, of course, her name is Charlotte Burks, and she has been in the state Senate ever since Senator Tommy Burks' death. And I know you're aware of this. She has been in particularly a strong advocate for victims' rights.
I know that to be the case.
How long did – when were you first elected to the bench?
1980. So it took took my position as the only circuit judge in two counties in September the 1st, 1980. And I think I tried my first-degree murder case within 60 days. And it was fast and furious from thereafter. You were there. You had started in the DA's office not too much earlier than that, I think.
That's correct. And I recall, I think the first trial that I was actively involved in involved the Bruce Benford homicide, where he was charged with killing his father.
Yes, and I think you'll remember that there was, in that trial, there was somebody else that took their pencil and pecked on the desk pretty regularly.
I think that would have been Mr. Dotson.
That's right.
Yeah, that was his way of telling me, I need to talk to you.
That's right.
Judge Daniel, getting back to the case of the Dicus and Reese, one of the things that we always like to know about, because when we're trying the case, and I know you're aware of this, you don't really know how it's coming across. And in this case, we had things like the cellmate of Mr. Dicus who testified against him. We had Deborah Reese, his co-defendant, who testified against him. We had scientific evidence in the form of the blood stains and the blood pattern analysis. And we had the store clerk. Of those, what had real impact to you, or how would you assess the value of those pieces of evidence?
Well, there's a cumulative effect of that evidence, obviously, but it seems to me, if my recollection is right, in this case, there was correspondence as well between the two co-defendants that was very incriminating as well. And so they would say one thing, but then their own internal attempted communications said something different. But each one of those types of evidence build on it, on themselves, for the credibility and reliability of the position. And I couldn't say one over the other, but the cumulative effect of it is overwhelming.
I imagine the number of trials you've had and the experience that you have, that a lot of times, and I use this term, grading the paper. You often grade the papers of the attorneys that are in front of you. Is it something that you see as you go through the trial, you wonder, why is this attorney doing this and why is that attorney doing that, and I would have done it differently? And how frustrating is it to you as a judge who thinks, I could do this better?
Well, I don't know if but I ever evaluated it as I could do it better, but you then will look at, and you don't want to involve yourself or inject yourself too much, because you don't want to affect the trial philosophy or the game plan that the attorney has. But as you look at a number of cases that any one of the attorneys have been involved in some cases you conclude they don't have a game plan, and those are cases that you really concern yourself. In other cases with certain attorneys or prosecutors, you know they do have a method in the way they're proceeding. I didn't want to involve myself in trying to interfere with it and try to redirect them where I thought it should go, because I knew they had a plan that they wanted it to go.
Judge Daniel, we're going to ask you to participate in a later segment, so we'll ask you to hang around for us,
sure.
And we'll take a break.
Thank you.
We bring people who know you, and you know them. People like Truman Jones. Weekday mornings at 9, only on WGNS. AM, FM, online.
Hello, this is Peter Demas with Demas's Restaurant, a family restaurant tradition for four generations, now in our 24th year, serving our most popular menu item, great-tasting oven-baked chicken soup. Back in 1989, when my mom and dad were planning Demas's, they debated whether baked chicken soup should even be on the menu. Both agreed that it was a good item, but they weren't sure it would be accepted. Because my dad and his sisters had eaten it all of their lives, especially when anybody had a bad cold, they decided to risk it. They did it, and now I can say the rest is history. We made over 65,000 gallons last year and make more every day. We sell it by the cup, bowl, quart, or gallon. You can even freeze it for shipping or to save it for a later date. Give yourself a treat today. Baked chicken soup, buy it in the store, or get it to go. Demas's Restaurant in Murfreesboro, Lebanon, downtown Nashville, and Hendersonville. Get your chicken soup today.
Jones Automatic Car Wash uses only microfiber towels to dry your car.
There's absolutely no lint any place on the car.
Only microfiber towels touch your car at Jones Car Wash.
Now with this microfiber towel we're using to do the windows and dry the car off, there's absolutely no lint. It just adds a little more quality to what we're trying to do.
That's Palmer Jones.
We appreciate you coming in, so thank you so much and have a good day.
Only Microsoft towels at Jones Car Wash on Memorial across from O'Charley.
Get well, live well at Northside Healthcare.
Here at Northside, we're a skilled nursing and rehabilitation center. If you get injured and you have to have surgery, but you're not quite able to go home, our facility acts as a transition place where you can come and get all the therapy, the one-on-one attention, and make sure that all of your meals are taken care of. We have activities for everybody to do.
Northside Healthcare on East MTCS Drive beside Middle Tennessee Christian School.
Murfreesboro Collision Center, serving Rutherford County since 1989. Get a free estimate on your fender bender today.
Hi, I'm David Ward. Here at Murfreesboro Collision Center, we use OEM parts to bring your car back to OEM specs.
Murfreesboro Collision Center has a long tradition of serving local residents.
At Murfreesboro Collision Center, the average repair usually takes less than 3 days.
Murfreesboro Collision Center, on Broad, at Northfield, behind Ford of Murfreesboro.
This is Inside the Courts, a look at this month's trials, pleas, and grand jury action. Inside the Courts is presented as a courtesy of the Rutherford County Clerk's Office.
We want to welcome to the program Robin Gentry, the Deputy Circuit Court Clerk for Rutherford County. And Robin, the grand jury did not meet this week, meets next week, so we do not have a grand jury report, but in May, we will discuss a significant action of the April grand jury. But let me state this before we begin. All of the defendants that we discuss under our law are presumed to be innocent. And with that as a prelude, could you tell us about any noteworthy trials that are scheduled in the Rutherford County courts in the near future?
Yes, General. Good morning. And we don't really have any murder trials or such coming up in the next couple of months. The first one we have docketed will be for June the 16th. That is going to be the trial of Jacob Pierman. He is charged with first-degree murder of his wife and the aggravated assault of her 7-year-old son. And Judge Bragg will be trying this case. June 30th. A couple weeks later, we've got another trial of Moses Best. This is a cold case murder where he killed his wife, or supposedly killed his wife, in 1986. And Judge Bragg will also try this case. August the 11th, we have the trial of Aaron Walker, and he is charged with the first-degree murder of Kevin Barrett, and who was an employee of the Rutherford County Board of Education. And Judge Bragg will be trying this case. And September the 30th, we have a trial of Kenny Hughes, who is charged with the first-degree murder of Trangiglia Wardlow. I never was able to pronounce that person's first name, but Judge Siskin's going to try this case.
Okay. Robin, I'm sure you've heard in the news lately there are reports of a scam that involve someone calling citizens and telling them that they've missed jury duty, they pose as an officer for the sheriff's department or some law enforcement agencies, and they say that because of that they've been fined and owe money to the courts and they demand a payment. Are you aware of that, and has anybody contacted the clerk's office? And if you would, tell us how to avoid that.
Well, don't send them any money. ask for proof. You're going to be notified if you've missed jury service. You're going to be notified one of two ways: that the clerk's office could call you, or you could be notified by the sheriff. But either way, they're going to tell you to report to the court, not tell you that you're fined and to send money.
And this is typically in the situation, they phrase it in such a way that the intended victim is fearful that if they don't pay the money, they're going to go to jail.
Right.
And obviously, before that could ever happen, the individual would have to appear in court before a judge.
That's right.
And so when you say the clerk's office contacts them, or maybe the sheriff, it wouldn't be to have them pay money. It would be for them to come to court and appear in front of the judge.
Yes.
And if, in fact, they had missed jury duty, they would be given the opportunity to explain what had happened.
Exactly.
Well, we want to thank you again this month for being part of the program. And thanks to your fellow workers in the clerk's office. They do a tremendous job, and they've always been a great help to my office. So thanks again for being with us this month.
Thank you.
This is Josh with South Branch Nursery. Planting season is finally here. South Branch Nursery has the largest selection of trees and shrubs in Middle Tennessee, and we even specialize in hard-to-find plants. Our knowledgeable staff can help you successfully plant anything from a shade tree to an entire landscape. The South Branch Nursery Landscape Team has been creating beautiful landscapes for over 20 years. Give us a call at 893-4030, just 2 miles south of I-24, past Indian Hills Golf Course.
Play it again, sports!
Your baseball and softball headquarters.
Whether it's bats, gloves, pants, or training aids, we've got a great selection to get you on the diamond this summer. Name brands like Easton, Louisville, Slugger, and Worth, but it played against sports prices. We're on Thompson Lane.
Good morning once again. Looking good in Murfreesboro with traffic easing. Broad at Church, Broad at Memorial, I-24 at 96, I-24 at 231, I-24 at Medical Center Parkway. Traffic easing. You've had the possibility of some ponding on those secondaries because of all the rain and the high winds have caused some problems involving tree limbs and trees down. So anticipate that as you travel through Murfreesboro today. Service Liquidation in Antioch is having a huge hardwood sale with pre-finished hardwood flooring and 3-inch wide planks, just $1.49 per square foot with several colors to choose from. Shop online, stoversliquidation.com. I'm Randy O'Brien with traffic on WGNS.
This is Candy Roberts Joyce, and I'm running for Murfreesboro City Council. I'm an MTSU graduate, and for the last 32 years, I've been a nonprofit manager. I'm the founding director of Leadership Rutherford, as well as the current chair of the St. Clair Senior Citizens Commission. It would be my honor to serve Murfreesboro on the City Council. I will access my years of listening and problem-solving skills to continue the progress of Murfreesboro, respect our history, and be your voice in our future plans. This is Candy Roberts Joyce, and I'm asking for your vote for Murfreesboro City Council.
Paid for by Candy Roberts Joyce for City Council, Mike Gentry, Treasurer.
Weather Eye.
A few spotty showers and storms early on this afternoon, some of which could be stronger than others, with cloudy skies, a high near 70, and it'll be rather breezy at times. I'm WGNS meteorologist Jennifer Wojcicki. Right now, 57.
Rutherford Issues with Brian Barrett. Weekday mornings at 10.
WGNS, your good neighbor station.
Rutherford County's place to talk. What's the law? Time now for an examination of the laws of Tennessee. This is not intended to be legal advice and is being presented solely for the informational benefit of our listening audience. You should always consult with an attorney whenever you need or rely on legal advice.
Paul, this morning I want to talk about a bill we have in the legislature, and I also want to talk again with Judge Daniel, who's still with us, about some things that involve his duties as a judge. But first I want to start with this. This is something I'm very passionate about, and I know you and I have talked about it a lot, but you recall from school the five W's: who, what, when, where, and why. And when you look at a criminal case, they certainly apply, and there's one more, it doesn't start with a W, but the how, the manner in which the crime was committed. But what I want to talk about is the who part of that. And the district attorneys, along with some other law enforcement agencies, did introduce a bill in the legislature. We tried to get it passed that would allow a picture of the murder victim to be presented to the jury so that they could see who the person was. That would seem almost so elementary that it would always be done. But over the last few years, our courts, more and more our appellate courts, have said, well, you have to have a reason to put the photograph in. Personally, to me, the reason of showing who was killed would be enough. I think that's relevant, who was killed. But the defense bar has been very adamantly opposed to it, and I understand that. They want to dehumanize the victim to a degree, and the photograph really puts in perspective this was a human being. Now, certainly there can be abuses. As you told me one time, we're not trying to introduce a picture of him sitting on Santa Claus's knee. We just want a photographic representation of what they look like. And it's inconceivable that we can't do that to me. I've always heard, put a face with a name. And we're reading the name in the indictment, and we're simply trying to show the jury who this person was. And, you know, every news story, when you're talking about somebody, what's the first thing you see? You see a picture of them. So it's not only human nature. I feel it's important to the case. If you think about it, if you're not killed, the jury gets to see you. In all likelihood, you're going to be a witness. You're going to be there in person. The defendant is there in person the entire trial. What harm can there be in showing one photograph of the victim so the jury can see who we're talking about? But that bill did not get out of committee. It got sent to summer study, which effectively kills it for this session. So we'll have to try and do that the next legislature. But I do want to give a shout out to Representative Rick Womack. He was the only one that voted in favor or against sending that to summer study. And he said, I want an up or down vote on it. So I appreciate his efforts on the behalf of the DA's conference. Having vented a little bit, I want to talk with Judge Daniel just a minute. And Judge, if you would tell us when you're on the bench, you know that many times cases get continued. The prosecutor always says one of the defense strategies, put it off. But tell us how do you decide whether or not to grant a continuance?
Well, that's an interesting question, because there's a lot of things that go into cases getting ready, and when they get to the point where they should be set and are set, then there's unpredicted things that happen. Somebody that is a key witness has a heart attack and is hospitalized. So those things you cannot plan for, and they necessitate resetting the case. But you want to keep the case always set to get it to be resolved one way or the other. And both sides are entitled to the resolution, the prosecution as well as the defendant. So the best policy is to keep it set always to a day certain, but you do have to take into consideration unforeseen events that give rise to a need to have it reset.
I've just went on my little rant about photographs and talking about the five or six questions: who, another one, what. We want to know what happened. We want to know when it happened, the date and the time, if possible, where it happened, and why. The why is the motive. And how, the manner in which, in particular, in the homicide case it occurred. But I want to talk a bit about the where, and that would be the crime scene. And many times the police, as you're aware, take numerous pictures of the crime scene. And sometimes those pictures may actually include photographs of the victim. And tell the folks listening how you balance what pictures of the crime scene come in, and also what pictures of the victim, maybe that are in the crime scene or suffered serious injuries. How do you balance that in determining what pictures can be admitted?
Well, obviously, those photographs document certain physical facts that, if they're germane to the issue, where, what, how, that they lend themselves to an explanation to the trier of fact, which is the jury. And some, you know, you've heard this said, a picture's worth a thousand words, and obviously those do convey better than you can articulate those events. The problem that comes into this scenario is that the cumulative effect, if there's huge numbers of pictures, you spend more time trying to sort out the probative value of having 15 pictures of the same thing come in, as opposed to just one that's clear and identifies the issue that you're trying to deal with. Now, when you get to the scenes of the victim, the appellate courts, in reviewing the use of the discretion of the trial court, have been pretty firm about preventing evidence that comes in that could be considered gory and gain sympathy simply because of the nature of the injury that's presented. Because you really don't know how it all came about. I mean, just the photograph doesn't demonstrate why and how you got to that point. So a trial court is going to be scrutinized pretty close as to whether or not that is appropriate to enter those types of pictures and the cumulative effect of it, particularly if you had a great number of them.
Yeah, and gruesome photographs, as you mentioned, they tend to inflame the jury or arouse their passions. Let me ask you one other question. Particularly in homicide cases, but in all criminal cases, the trial court sentences. And we mentioned in the Dicus case, in addition to the life without parole, which the jury imposed because it's first-degree murder case, then you, in addition to that, impose an additional 24 years. What factors go in to deciding what is an appropriate sentence for an individual?
Well, the statutes give rise to the criteria that the trial judge is to consider in setting a sentence. And so, first of all, you're going to be reviewed pretty carefully about whether or not the evidence does document one of those factors if you're going to enhance the sentence, which in this case I did. And there was probably in Dicus, and I don't remember all the various factors, but there was a plot, there was action in which they were taking advantage of an elderly person, there was theft, there was a number of different factors that came about in that case that gave rise to me deviating from the standard, a ranged sentence to a second standard, and then running it consecutive. And not all of the time do you get affirmed on that. Many times you make a mistake. You don't intentionally make a mistake, but you saw or felt like a factor was proven, and the appellate court, in reviewing the record, disagrees with you. Mm-hmm. And so those are the things that you consider in making that determination.
And I think in Mr. Dykes' case, he had a pretty severe prior criminal record.
That's right.
And that's a big factor.
Big factor.
And then in a case of that nature, one of the criteria for running the sentence consecutive is that the individual is a dangerous offender. In other words, he's danger to the public at large. And that's a factor in running the sentence consecutive.
Or he may have been on probation or parole. I don't remember in that case. I don't remember.
Well, I really want to thank you for being here. And as you mentioned, you were elected in 1980. Our careers have paralleled each other. In addition to being a trial judge, you served as an appellate judge, special judge on many occasions. I know you took senior status and traveled around the state hearing cases. And I want to thank you for your service not only to Rutherford County but to the entire state of Tennessee. I can't say I'm disappointed that you beat me in retiring before I did, but I'm looking forward to joining you now in the ranks of the retired as of August 31st. So, again, I appreciate you being here, and I hope to see you at the fishing hole.
All right. Good to see you, General.
This is MTSU President Sidney McPhee. You're listening to WGNS, your local connection to Blue Raider Athletics.
WGNS AM, FM, online, weather eye.
Tennessee, these spotty showers and storms early on this afternoon, some of which could be stronger than others, with cloudy skies, a high near 70, and it'll be rather breezy at times. I'm WGNS meteorologist Jennifer Wojcicki. Right now, 57.
Thank you for making our first 5 years here in Murfreesboro so successful. This is Frieda Morgan with First National Bank of Murfreesboro, 2230 Mercury Boulevard. Call 615-494-4200. Member FDIC.
Don't throw away old flags. WGNS retires Old Glory with respect. Bring those tattered Bibles here too. We're more than talk. Every homicide, every rape, every robbery affects the entire community. People who are victims of these crimes need closure. The people who committed these crimes must be held accountable. Law enforcement needs the community's help in seeking justice. Please listen as we review an unsolved mystery in this month's Cold Case Profile.
About 3 in the afternoon on March 25th, 1977, two Murfreesboro residents are walking down Van Cleef Lane in the Stones River National Battlefield. It is a walk they will never forget. For on this walk, they make a grisly discovery. They find a body of the young man behind some bushes. The location is near an abandoned house on Van Cleef Lane. Because the body was found in a federal park, the Federal Bureau of Investigation is contacted. Federal officials theorize the murder occurred the night before the body was discovered. Federal agents also believe the body had been dragged about 30 feet, probably to conceal it from motorists on Van Cleef Lane. FBI agents ask for assistance from the Murfreesboro Police Department and the Rutherford County Sheriff's Office. Sheriff Craig Snell becomes involved in the case. Later, the autopsy results are released. Sheriff Snell says that Stanley Smith died as a result of two gunshot wounds, one in the neck and one in the temple. Sheriff Snell also said the murder weapon was believed to be a .32 caliber pistol. As the case continued to be investigated, law enforcement believe the murder may have been drug-related. The abandoned home near the body was thought to be a drop house for drugs and stolen property. Investigators focused on three men who reportedly left town shortly after the murder. During the investigation, it was also learned that a possible suspect had left town 2 days after Stanley Smith's body was found. Efforts to prosecute that suspect or anyone else have not been successful. Stanley Smith was 26 years old at the time of his death. He had a family and lived here in Murfreesboro on Richmond Avenue. His family and friends want answers, and they want justice for Stanley Smith. It has been 37 years since one or more people took the life of Stanley Smith. Law enforcement now ask for your help. If you have any information regarding this case, please contact Detective Jan Goodwin of the Rutherford County Sheriff's Office. With us today is Detective Sergeant Dan Goodwin. Detective Goodwin, we want to welcome you to the broadcast.
Morning, Paul.
Detective Goodwin, I read in the statement of facts where the body was believed to have been found in the Stones River National Battlefield. And then later it appears that it was determined that it really wasn't in the battlefield. Can you explain all that to us?
In talking to some of the earlier investigators, when they arrived on the scene, our local folks, Murfreesboro and the sheriff's office, they were met by a park ranger who explained to them that it was on federal property and it had to be investigated by the FBI. So 3 hours later, they were called back to the scene by the FBI. FBI remained in general lead of the case for one full week before suddenly finding out that his body was located 6 feet outside the actual property line of the park, and they tossed it right back to Sheriff Snell and his detectives, and they were not pleased at this turn of events. Basically, three agencies. Back then, it was a much smaller community. Murfreesboro, PD, and the sheriff's office worked hand-in-hand on many cases, and there was only a handful of detectives. So everyone worked closely, including the feds, until they departed. And suspects were developed. And Paul, this is one of those cases, as we've heard before, everyone in town knew who was behind this crime. And what we're looking for now is for people to come forward. 37 years is a very long time, and there are folks in this town who've heard admissions from the people who were involved in this, and we need to talk to those folks to see if we can get some sort of justice for Stanley Smith's family. He had, I've talked to one of his sons. He was 3 years old, and it's a life-shattering event for a boy that age. He grew up completely fatherless, and it hasn't turned out well for him.
Looking at the time period, and you heard me say that it was 37 years, is this one of the oldest cold cases that the sheriff's office is investigating?
Yes, sir. This is our very oldest case. Prior to the administration of Sheriff Snell, we have no records on murders that occurred before this date.
Okay. Now, from listening to you, it appears that although this may be the oldest case, this may not be the coldest case, because there are some leads or some information that you think could lead to conviction.
Yes, sir. We're following up on some stuff. We're looking, we've located some of the evidence that was collected in this and are looking for other pieces that may be extant that could actually be submitted for scientific testing.
Now, one of the things that you have to do in these cold case investigations, I know this from working with you, is that you have to contact the former detectives that were present 37 years ago. And you had to actually contact some of them in preparation for this broadcast. How important is it to have a relationship with the detectives and the police officers from back during that time?
It's quite important. The work they did is what we're going to base what we can find out now. And the time is on our side in all these cold cases. It's a matter of the relationships change. Some of these people who probably worked together on this may not be friends anymore, and they've certainly told a number of people about the crimes.
Now, if someone has information or if someone has had information for a long time, and now has decided that they want to come forward, who do they contact and how do they contact them?
They can call me directly and leave a message on my phone. That is 615-904-3034.
As we end the program, we want to thank all of our guests for appearing today. A special thanks to Judge Steve Daniel. His service to the community is very much admired and appreciated. And we also appreciate WGNS for providing the airtime. Most of all, we thank all of the listeners. Our next scheduled broadcast is Friday morning, May the 2nd, between 8 and 9 a.m. We leave by saying, a safe community is the responsibility of each and every one of us. For Bill Weitzel, this is Paul Newman, bidding all of you a safe and blessed day.